My guest this week is Rob Wetherill, a psychoanalyst who trained in Monkstown County, Dublin. Rob's latest book is called Forgetting Freud, Is Psychoanalysis in Retreat? Rob Wetherill, you're welcome. Well, is it in retreat?
I think it is. It's been marginalised by counselling and therapy, an explosion in the latter in the last 20 or 30 years. And psychoanalysis now accounts for quite a small proportion of the broader therapeutic network, if you like, outside the psychiatric system.
So the market can be quite cruel in that sense, yeah.
The market is very cruel, but also psychoanalysis itself, not only has it been marginalised, it's also, in a certain sense, retreated into the academy and onto cultural studies courses, feminist courses, and so on. And it no longer has a reach to the wider public.
So gaining ground in universities and losing out in terms of the general population.
Exactly. I mean, for instance, it's hard to imagine now that in the mid-1980s, Michael Ignatieff did a series on Channel 4, I think it was, where he interviewed various analysts for sort of an hour and a half in peak television time. That wouldn't happen now.
Wouldn't happen now.
Which is unfortunate, because psychoanalysis, obviously, I would say, has an awful lot to say.
Yeah. That wouldn't happen, of course, for a variety of reasons, perhaps not all of them to do with the status of psychoanalysis itself. One thing I remember from that series, it was one of the most cogent arguments against psychoanalysis. It seems to me it's one that's difficult to answer, and it's this: that secrets which are prized open on the couch have a value. Therefore, you know, often they're the wellspring of creativity. And is there a danger that psychoanalysis could make inroads on that?
I don't think so really now, because when you say prized open, secrets aren't prized open anymore. I mean, people are allowed to be and have their space and to speak. You know, the person reveals really as much as they want to reveal. They're not required to lay themselves bare, as it were.
So you can hold on to what you believe are the wellsprings of your own creativity.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the fact access to the unconscious increases creativity by and large. Mm.
How did you, Rob, get into psychoanalysis?
Really through contact with the so-called Monkstown group, which was the Hanahan group. I didn't meet Hanahan himself. He died 2 years before I came here in 1969. He was inspirational for me, as he was for many other people. And I suppose I'm still, when I think about it, quite influenced by the way that he thought.
Which is very different
to the way analysts think today.
Right. What was unique about his approach?
I think he was a visionary in the sense that he believed that psychoanalysis should be linked to the wider culture and should comment on the wider culture. And he thought that psychoanalysis held a way of understanding modern culture, which and the what he called the European spirit, that he believed was in decline in the 20th century, and so he had a quite a visionary view of, I suppose, conflict. I mean, after all, psychoanalysis is really a conflict theory. It's unique in that sense. It's based on conflict between parents and children, men and women, masculinity and femininity, between races, between classes, conflict, life versus death. And therefore, it's a very dramatic theory. So this was Hanahan's view. I think we've lost a lot of that now.
What does psychoanalysis bring to that conflict? I mean, broadly, what kind of perspective?
It brings, first of all, an elaboration of it, rather than trying to cover it up, which is really what I would argue therapy culture does, tries to cover up the conflict and be positive. Psychoanalysis goes in the reverse direction and opens up the conflict and dwells amongst the conflictual parties, if you like. And of course, on an individual level, that is, if you like, dwelling close to the unconscious, which is in conflict with the conscious in ordinary human subjects.
So, but presumably other therapies, or do they deal with the conflict as well?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I think pretty well universally they deal with looking forward, upping your game, you know,
feeling
the power
good,
of now,
feeling good.
Yourself, I think they really, and this is another reason why psychoanalysis has been marginalized to some degree, because it's of its perceived negativity and pessimism, which I would argue, many others have argued, indeed, was Freud's initially, Freud's realism rather than pessimism.
And that's something you want to, I can see from your own book, very much want to hold on to, that sense of the constraints that act on us all the time.
Yes. Mm. I suppose every chapter in the book in some ways is trying to reconnect psychoanalysis, as I say, with the night. In other words, with radical evil, if you like, which, you know, again, doesn't exist, in inverted commas, in the contemporary world.
By which you mean that people try to pretend it
exactly,
yes.
You've only got to take the current financial crisis to see how again and again we refuse to see how bad it is, and hence it drags on. But I suppose what I'm elaborating in the book, just to situate it a little bit better, were the two cultural revolutions, the revolution of the 60s, which was a revolution in lifestyle, where you could adopt any lifestyle you wanted. So that was a revolution for the new left, as it were. And then that was completed by a revolution in the Thatcherite years during the 80s, which was greed is good. And that liberated people to make money. So we had free lifestyle choice, and then we had free ability to make money.
So these two revolutions. Right. So if freedom is absolutized to that degree, what is being ignored?
I think a way to live. You know, I mean, children now come into the world, and they actually don't have a world in which to live in, in the sense that a world which precedes them, which is relatively predictable. They have a world now where, you know, you don't know whether when you should go to bed or when you should get up, when you should get married or whether you should get married. We don't even know necessarily what to eat anymore.
So you're saying the loss of some kind of sense of order, of authority?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And while that's desirable, up to a point, and we wouldn't wish to go back. There's no sense of nostalgia here to go back to the 1950s, say. It nevertheless creates huge problems in terms of mental health, because people, many of us, unless one's middle class and very well brought up, we don't know actually how to live. And therefore you get various extremes, well, in particular addictions, I suppose, are the result of this. People living, if you like, excessively, because there's no breaks anymore. I mean, we are one of the ads, I think, going down into Tesco is give in to temptation. You know, this is a complete reversal to all former generations who were told to not to be tempted. But now it's give in to temptation. You see, the complete reversal of values.
As you speak, I can see the elders in our society are going to love you. They're saying, oh, he's singing our tune. You know, we're not listening. We're not listened to enough. We're not. So, you know, what you're saying, there's the balance. We've no longer got the balance right between freedom and authority.
Yes, and I think this bears most upon children. Mm. Because they are growing up now, a whole generation in the internet age, where these barriers are completely down. Anything is up for grabs. And that's fine if you have some kind of family structure that supports you and provides for you. But if you don't, then there is a crisis. And we have a financial crisis, of course. But there's also, if you like, and this would be going back to a sort of Hanahan type of language, a sort of psycho-spiritual crisis as well.
What did he mean, Hanahan, that is, by the sense of a decline of the European spirit? What did he mean by that?
I think he meant, well, in today's terms, I think he would, you know, have talked about the growing inequality between rich and poor, the the tendency of elites nowadays not to really care about the rest of society, to put them, to hide themselves behind gated communities, have private health, private education, to desert the public space. I think this is what he...
It's very interesting. It's related to the absolutizing of freedom, isn't it? Because there's a sense in which freedom is absolutized, not simply in terms of pleasure being king and the absence of authority, but also, if you look at, say, American politics, a classic example, where, you know, let's not have state interference of any kind, let's not interfere with the freedom of the individual. It's there too, yes.
Absolutely. And you've got, see, both those revolutions of the left and the right completed the circle of freedom.
Yes, of course, we were saying that earlier about the Thatcher years, in a sense, was very much the beginning of that. So you've had the whole sort of, if you like, you see, there's two sides to the map, isn't there? On the one hand, you can counterpoint freedom with authority. You can also counterpoint freedom with equality.
Exactly.
So, that's been lost out as well.
Yes, and, you know, the freedom to make money, for instance, which is required by capitalism, to make capitalism work, has pretty devastating consequences. And I think Hanahan was picking up on that already in the 50s and 60s, but he was ahead of the game, if you were.
I mean, the point is that the Soviet Union absolutized the other side of the equation, and of course that led to even greater disaster.
Oh, absolutely, But I suppose to come back to psychoanalysis,
right.
what part does psychoanalysis play in this? I think psychoanalysis has the tools in a way to be able to analyze this problem and the effects on individuals.
Well, does it? Is there a politics implicit in psychoanalysis?
There is, of course, and it's a liberationist politics. And that's partly what I'm questioning in the book, that psychoanalysis needs, if it's going to last, and that's a big question, whether it will last through this century, it needs to do something in relation to, I suppose, what we could call cultural relativism. It somehow or other has to come down. It cannot remain neutral, that it has to come down with some authority and say something in relation to this moral relativism.
Yes, I mean, for example, to be fully human will sustain a wide range of descriptions, but it won't sustain all descriptions, isn't that right? I mean, there are certain things that you can't do or be if you're to call yourself fully human.
Yes, and what does fully human mean?
Well, I mean, by fully human, I mean however you care to define it in terms of what one is capable of being. What I'm saying is that however you define that, and obviously that will vary, there are certain kinds of behavior that by definition are not sustainable under that heading. For example, some destructive behavior, for one.
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the question is now, there would even be a big debate over what is regarded as destructive.
Would there really? Yes. Yeah.
Don't you think?
Well, I'm not being devil's advocate, if I may invoke. But I think that the sense of destructive. No, you just made me think. Now that's no bad thing to do. But is destructive a? Give me an example of the kind of conflict you might find.
Well, one person's destructiveness is another person's creativity, isn't it? And I mean that we have to take that
example,
very seriously.
Example.
Well, for instance, any breaking of new ground in any art form could be seen as destructive.
Because we have Schumpeter's famous creative destruction, where you've got to cleave the way. But that's sort of cheating, isn't it? I mean, there is a kind of legitimate destruction that is paving the way for new things.
Yes. I mean, I think most people would agree that excessive bankers' salaries probably is destructive.
Yes.
I don't think we'd have
too much of a debate about that.
There.
Whereas you could say, for example, that you know, in tearing something down is legitimate if it's paving the way for something valuable in its place.
You could argue, is spraying the city streets with graffiti, is that creative or is that destructive?
Well, let me put it another way.
I'm just thinking of examples.
Sure. When you think of the term evil, I mean, for example, if I think of evil, destructiveness immediately comes to mind. What comes to mind for you?
Well, I suppose what comes to mind is, fairly obviously things like the Holocaust that I make many, many references to in the book. I suppose currently what's going on in Syria
These are examples, and I'm not being unfair here. I mean, just think of a concept, what of an idea when you think of evil. What notion is generally going to embody it? Can you think of one better than destructiveness? Some idea that's going to embody it or contain it. At any rate in the psychoanalytic encounter. To what extent, how does that manifest itself in what one might call these kind of destructive impulses, or how are they dealt with in the psychoanalytic context?
Well, I suppose bringing them to light. That sounds a rather limp kind of way of putting it, but that in the psychoanalytic session, one I suppose, in the old language, one comes face to face with one's demons. Things that are very problematic in one's life, and that's why people come for analysis in the first place very often.
Give me an example, and again, obviously, we don't have to pry into individual cases, but in your own experience as an analyst, of those moments where for the first time someone is encountering that side of themselves or that aspect, what tends to happen? Can it be quite shattering? Would it mean the end of that evening's conversation and perhaps not coming back for a while? How is that usually dealt with?
It's not normally as shattering as that, because often the person has some awareness of it when they arrive and they want to talk about it. I mean, it might be some external event, like something that's happened to them, like, say, sexual abuse or maybe some tragedy in the family, which has thrown up a huge number of problems. Or on the other hand, it could be a personal proclivity that someone feels ashamed of, something sexual, some sexual event in their childhood, these sorts of things which cause them a lot of anxiety. Or it can indeed be things like intrusive thoughts, where unbidden thoughts of a violent nature that someone feels they can't control, and yet come to them every day or every so often, or indeed a depression that comes over a person, a very dark mood, a withdrawal, or something of this nature, which the job of the analysis is to slowly unpack and see what are the dynamics behind it? You know, how did it arise? How can it be lived with in some way, in some different way, through talking?
Something like depression. I mean, the received view seems to be now that in treating it's a combination of drugs and of talk. What value has psychoanalysis brought to say a problem of that kind, or what by way of help?
It's hard to be specific, but the notion that talking leads to the unconscious, and therefore to the person's individual history, to how they were formed, how their being was formed in the family, this can alleviate depression. Mm. But I mean, one has to be careful to be too positive, because there's no knowing how things will go once you start to speak. But speaking in the analytic session is different to ordinary speaking. We're listening to the various layers in language, and particularly the unconscious layers that peep through, as it were, the ordinary speech.
So listening is at the heart of it.
Listening is the key. Listening on the part of the analyst, and then the person learns to, as it were, listen to themselves and to be able to re-engage with themselves, something very often for the first time, because, as Heidegger said, you know, we're thrown into the world and we, you know, we cope as best we can. And analysis is a chance to have a look again at how we were formed and how things have shaped us, and therefore gives us a chance to orientate ourselves differently in the future.
I heard someone say once that Jacques Lacan, whom you deal with in the book,
yes,
the great French analyst, that what he brought to the table was a new way of listening, did he?
Absolutely. Listening to what he called the signifiers, which are just precisely those words and phrases which form us. He had this idea that language, in a sense, shapes us. Language in the very largest sense, the culture that we're born into shapes us.
Can you give me an example? Do you mean that those kind of expressions that we tend to use over and over again, is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
There may be expressions that we use over and over again, or it may be a slip that we make reveals something. You know, we do this in ordinary conversation, and you think, you know, God, I wish I hadn't said that. Very often the opposite of what we consciously desire. Hence back to this conflict notion that what we consciously desire and what we unconsciously desire are often in radical conflict with each other. And that is what we go into. So when we speak, it's impossible if we speak freely, not like I'm doing now where I'm trying to concentrate on what I'm saying, but if we speak freely under this rule of free association, then the unconscious emerges in various slips, so-called Freudian slips, but also in dreams, in fantasies, in jokes.
Do you find it hard? I mean, do you find that when your patients come in first, that they're generally guarded? Does it take a while to get to that point of what you call that kind of free, non-concentrated talk?
Yes, it can take a long time because we are so goal-oriented, and we're told to be goal-oriented these days, you know, to wake up and smell the coffee and all of that kind of thing. And it's quite hard to go, therefore, in the reverse direction. And psychoanalysis is quite subversive of today's culture.
A kind of purposelessness.
Absolutely, yes. Which is a rare thing. And the psychoanalytic space that's created by the analyst is precisely for that freewheeling consciousness, hence the link with creativity, and that there's no need therefore for it to in any way limit or destroy creativity, but in fact to release it.
You're a listener, of course, and you say, to what extent are you an interpreter?
Not very much these days, because as Lacan, who you referred to, said, the unconscious in a way interprets itself. You know, once the slip is made, it's out there. And very often we recognize the error and we sort of try to recant it and say, look, I didn't mean that. And, you know, politicians are doing this all the time, and we find it very amusing.
I have heard analysts say, I mean, talking about the Freudian context generally, that if someone makes a slip of the tongue or whatever, that has to be, can't be seen just by itself. It has to be seen in the context of other things they're doing or saying. That would make sense, wouldn't it?
Yes, and therefore what is sometimes called wild analysis, which is what people do in public, you know, with their friends, is not a good idea, because you don't know the context. Now, the analyst, because the analyst has been listening to the person for hours and hours, knows the context, or increasingly knows the context, and therefore the slip becomes something much more significant in that, rather than picking it up on the very first slip the person makes. We don't know, and very often we don't know what a dream means. It's only much later that a dream seems to signify something. And to come back to your question about interpretation, no longer does the analyst sort of interpret from on high and say, this means that, you know, by the way, you have this particular complex. That is really...
Can I ask you, you say no longer, that was the case, wasn't it? Yes.
It was. Classical psychoanalysis proceeded along those lines, and there are some analysts who still work like that. But they, I'd say they would be lesser now because... people feel rightly objectified in that, and it alters the whole spirit of analysis.
What is social media doing to our capacity, first of all, to listen to ourselves?
I think, I would say this, wouldn't I? I mean, I think they're destroying that, because, in fact, there's so much immediacy in social media and in the internet generally, that there's no space for reflection. Or very little space for reflection. And as I say, this impacts upon the young who in a certain sense have known nothing else. And whereas, say, my generation, who's lived for most of our lives without the internet and without social media, we take reading and reflection for granted, but, you know, insofar as we're educated. And this is why there is a growing gap now, I think, between the, if you like, the educated classes and those who fall by the wayside in that respect.
Just before we leave, something I want to ask you to decode. It's a line from Levinas, the great French philosopher, whom you quote as saying that when friends meet on the street, their first words end an instant of unbearable closeness.
That's right. That's a quote from him?
Yes. To unpack that.
Yeah. I think because through language we can distance ourselves. That, you know, by if you like, chat, by talking, we in a sense stop the unbearable closeness that comes, say, for instance, during a heightened experience, maybe a sexual experience, or a tragic experience when we can't find any words. That's when we're incredibly close to the other person. But normally we prefer more distance, and language provides that distance and all the symbolic forms that go with language, all the tricks we have for maintaining that distance, but not at a certain distance, not completely separate. I don't know if that answers
Those language breaks the spell, in effect.
Exactly, yes. And creates a separateness from each other.
Yeah.
Which is essential, and which is also maintained in the analytic dialogue, where the person, has to come back to your earlier point, they're not prized open. They are allowed their core of their being, if you like, to remain intact. It's only very gradually that one might approach these conflicts that I'm referring to.
In other words, there's an element of mutuality in whatever opening up occurs.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, obviously there's an asymmetry in the relationship, mm-hmm, in that one person pays and the other person is paid, and one person listens and the other person speaks. But on the other hand, there is, and there must, it must be grounded in a certain human warmth.
Robert Wetherill, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.